Hi, it's Fraser here. Before we kick off with this week's Spike podcast, I just wanted to let you know about Heretics. Heretics is one of my favourite podcasts, hosted by the brilliant Andrew Gold. Each episode is a deep dive with a fascinating guest. Recent ones have included Richard Dawkins, Douglas Murray, Constantine Kissin, Liz Truss, and even Robbie Williams. What I love about Heretics is that it's bold, surprising, and always thought-provoking. Andrew doesn't play it safe. He challenges ideas from all sides and even asks some quite out there and sometimes cheeky questions. Whether you agree with it or not, you'll always come away thinking differently. It's the kind of podcast you'd recommend to some of your smartest friends. To get started, just search for Heretics wherever you get your podcasts and let Andrew know that we sent you.
There's now questioning of the social justice movement, even on the center-left elites. Donald Trump rescinded an executive order of President Lyndon Johnson. That's right. 60 years ago. Things which were largely unquestioned and unchallenged for 50, 60 years from the early days of the progressive moment. There's the line that's been drawn.
Yeah.
And things are not going to be the same from now on.
Hello, I'm Fraser Myers, Deputy Editor of Spiked. Absolutely delighted to be joined by Eric Kaufman.
Fraser, it's great to be here.
Eric, we're speaking at the Heterodox Social Science Conference, a conference you organized. Can you tell us a bit about why you organized it and give us a bit of a flavor of what kind of discussions have been happening?
Yeah, why did I organize this? Well, okay, I have attended gatherings of large number of heterodox scholars. So the Stanford Academic Freedom Conference, which has some overlap with this. But my aim here is actually to be quite purposeful in that there is a sort of research agenda here, not just we're going to gripe about how we've been canceled and how awful it is. But that's part of it. But part of it is to say, okay, we have a social science in which many questions have never been asked or certain viewpoints are not allowed. So explaining racial inequality by anything other than systemic racism is essentially more or less taboo. When actually probably the real drivers are not that. So we actually should, if we were kind of had a properly functioning social science, we should have most of the work on the actual drivers and maybe only a little work on systemic racism, let's say. So one strand of this research agenda is just to say, we got to fill in all these blanks to prevent this warped knowledge that's being created. The second, however, is really about this outpouring of books on critical social justice or woke or whatever we want to call it. I think woke is the most appropriate term. And so what we actually need, if this was a normal phenomenon like, Islamic revival or nationalism or communism, we would have conferences, we would have journals, we would have, edited books and courses on this subject, and they would be mushrooming and exploding. So we've seen that with the populist right. There are hundreds of thousands of papers now on the populist right and whole conferences and associations. When it comes to woke, which has been every bit as big a phenomenon, if you look at the press and you look at activity and politics, there's crickets from academia. So we actually need, this is partly about saying, hey, let's take stock of all the books that have come out in the last 5-6 years, which are a new discipline. So we need to have a critical woke studies conference. That is all not about saying we hate woke. It's about saying, here's a real ideology we should be studying. And there are now competing schools of thought. You've got people who think it's about class and status and luxury beliefs. So it's more cynical. Then you have like people that's more religious, it's a mind virus, and it's true belief. These are like separate theoretical schools, so it's time to have disciplinary conferences. So that's kind of like the two parts of this. And then the third part is really partly to take stock of our moment, which I style as kind of post-progressive. There's now questioning of the social justice movement, even on the center-left elites, at least in the U.S., there's much more of a sense that this went too far. Maybe it's got some things wrong. Maybe we need to kind of recalibrate. And I think that's a good moment to just have a conference like this.
Definitely. I definitely want to talk about that in a bit more detail. But can you give a sense of what happens when you're in the social sciences, say you're a young academic, either, you find the wrong thing or you're interested in the wrong subjects. What happens?
Well, I mean, we have just basically what happens is you're unlikely, if you voice your views, depending on what those views are, if they're, very controversial, you may actually get run out of your department. But most of the time that won't happen. I mean, most of the time it's just you won't be hired or promoted or published, or you might just be socially ostracized. No one will want to sit with you in the canteen. So these are kind of social punishments to get you to conform.
Yeah.
I think that is probably the best way of saying, you know, this is, if you actually are heterodox in your views and you push against the cultural left narrative, that's going to be your experience. So as in any organization, the nonconformists are going to get punished, and this is the way it's done in academia.
And what effect does this have on the sort of wider culture? Because there will be some people who think, well, it's just, you know, it's just in the university. They're always like this. Does it have an impact on broader politics, society, policy, maybe?
I think it does. Now, I think this is where there's a big difference between like the late 80s, early 90s, what I would call the second awakening, which stayed largely on campus, and a few elite magazines.
Sort of political correctness.
Yeah, political correctness and all of that. What the big difference in this third awakening or the great awakening is it really surged off campus. You know, Andrew Sullivan says we all live on campus now. And that's because social media put, you know, academics in touch with journalists, and the media really had to drive outrage and clicks in order to make money. So they really leaned into some of these social justice themes. And because there was such a big surge off campus, the average person, some people started to notice that their free speech was much less free. Mm. You had, you know, critical race and gender ideology in schools and the trans issue. So suddenly we're now seeing it in elections, in politics, in a way that wasn't true in the 80s and 90s. So it's much more consequential for society now. Now, the other thing I will say, too, is the culture war is not just the culture war. So the downstream effect of the culture war is you can't deport anybody that's racist. You can't incarcerate anybody, too many people, because that's racist. You can't punish people, exclude them from class because that's racist. And it had all these effects like more crime, worse educational outcomes, can't control the borders. So then all of a sudden that becomes visible to the public and you get a populist backlash and polarization. So it's much more consequential, I would say, than the second awakening, which did have some political ripple effects, but nothing like we're seeing now.
And as you said, you think that we're in a post-progressive era, and you're writing the Wall Street Journal recently about this. And you said, and this might surprise some people, that this is bringing an end to a 60-year process, whereas most people might think this has gone on for 10 years, 20 years at best. What are you referring to there when you talk about a 60-year process?
Right. Well, so I'm referring to, for example, now a questioning of affirmative action, which goes back to the mid-1960s. And so Donald Trump rescinded an executive order of President Lyndon Johnson. That's 60 years ago. The Republican administration is now issuing guidelines that are essentially preventing the use of something called disparate impact law, which says if you put in a standardized test and whites do better than blacks or men do better than women, that will be presumed to be racist or sexist. That is being essentially stopped. That's 50 years old and attacking sort of speech codes, which are 40 years old. So we have things, it's not just the last 5 or 10 years, things which were largely unquestioned and unchallenged for 50, 60 years from the early days of the progressive moment, which starts in the mid-60s, the cultural left domination of societies and culture. So there's an attempt to peel back, to roll back things back 60 years, not on everything. You know, we're not going to roll back gay rights and women's rights and black rights. But when it comes to the excesses, which were already evident in the 60s, there's now an energy to reexamine those things. And there's not that much defense coming from at least the elite liberals. They're now kind of saying, yeah, you know, maybe, you know, unequal treatment to obtain equal results is not such a good idea. Racially discriminating in order to achieve perfect racial representation is maybe not the best thing to do. And so it's kind of a recognition of the failure of what at one time might have been seen as, yeah, this policy is going to lead to equality of outcome. And it's the same thing as equal treatment. Now there's almost kind of like a sense that actually this is not achieved equal outcomes. It's not a good policy. It's just causing division. I think this is a very significant moment because it's leading to a reexamination of everything that's happened in the last 60 years. And therefore, I think the dispensation that we've been under in the last 60 years, I think really we're drawing a line. I think we can say there's a line that's been drawn.
Yeah.
And things are not going to be the same from now on. And I think that's going to change elite culture, in many ways.
And returning to the university, obviously there's people like yourself reforming things from within to a certain extent, or at least trying to.
Yeah.
Whether they are reformable is another question. There's also Trump, who is, I'd be interested to get your take on some of his actions, because many people who are, you know, on the side of academic freedom, on the side of free speech, actually say he's doing more harm than good. What is your take on that?
I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, in the plus category, he's shown the gumption to go after some, you know, something like, for example, affirmative action and enforce it, to enforce reverse discrimination, to take universities to task for essentially being monocultures. Those are important demonstration effects that will affect other political actors around the world, in Britain, in Canada, maybe, depending on things, you know, a long time down the road. But so the demonstration effect that this is the art of the possible. So that's been very good. What's been more negative in my estimation is some of the double standards. So, for example, if you say universities, you got to get rid of DEI on race and sex and sexuality, but we want you to do DEI for conservatives because you don't have enough viewpoint diversity. Clearly, that is a kind of logic or a contradiction in terms of principle. And even Chris Rufo today, I mean, as you saw, or if you were there in the session, he thought that the sort of mandated viewpoint diversity aspect of the Trump's letter actually didn't make much sense.
Right.
And so I think there's a contradiction there. Likewise on free speech, you know, to say, you know, to make free speech a center point of what you're talking about with universities censoring and getting low free speech rankings, which is an abomination, and it's all true. But then essentially really to chill speech critical of Israel, and to go well beyond the law and the First Amendment on Israel, Jews, etc. I think that's also inconsistent. On the funding side, I think, you know, to burn down the house to kill a mouse, not a mouse, but it is much more than a mouse. It's a big problem, but going after good research funding, in the quest to sort of punish the Harvards who have been racially discriminating, politically pontificating. They do deserve to be punished. But I just worry that in a sense, this isn't a principled attack. It comes across as a retribution and a tit for tat. So it's all about power. We got power now. We're going to use it rather than you've been morally wrong. You violated non-discrimination. You violated the pursuit of truth and enlightenment values in order to pursue partisan politics. This is quite a strong partisan, quite a strong moral case. My worry also is that Trump is not the best person to make a moral argument because he's clearly very compromised ethically and morally. But with all of those caveats, I think there's still a lot of positive there. And I think there's still hope to right things and make it more of something that can really change the culture.
And finally, as we hopefully enter this post-progressive world, what do you think would be the hardest battles to fight, the hardest things to get rid of?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a degree to which people whose values crystallize in their 20s, it's going to be very hard to change their minds, I think. The true believing 10 up to 15% are going to be with us for a while, and there are more of them among young people, I think. And so as they become the median voter, there's going to be a problem potentially with free speech. We've now seen a counter-mobilization among young people, so I think they're just going to be quite polarized. So the battle will certainly be in the Gen Zers as well going forward. So I think the attitudinal change is going to be the hardest nut to fully crack. I also think that it's not enough to issue a decree like, you know, you must get rid of a DEI. There's going to have to be structures set up. So regular reporting to Parliament in this country, or perhaps to the president, you have to set up, reshape the political institutions in the U.S., the EEOC and the Justice Department, so that you are constantly, you've got your shoe on the neck of these organizations, because there will be so much pressure to resist, not to fire the DEI staff, to kind of respawn and to reshape, to shape shift in order to preserve the mission. So one example would be, no, we have to keep the percentage of African Americans at Harvard at 12% or whatever it is. Regardless. And so if we're not allowed to discriminate, then we have to ask these subtle questions, which are proxies, which can still get us there. And those efforts have to be combated so that in fact they are obeying the law. And that's going to be a matter of stamina. Similarly on, I worry about schooling in particular more than almost than the universities, that the content of school curricula, what the teachers are teaching in the classroom, that also has to be monitored. And there has to be a penalty for indoctrination. And I don't think we're yet at the position where we are looking at the curriculum and saying, you can teach slavery in proportion to other subjects. You can't do that without teaching about non-Western slavery. And we can talk about Western slavery, but only in relation to non-Western slavery and the history of slavery going back 6,000 years. Fine. Because it's putting it in the proper context so that people don't think, as, you know, 70% of African Americans do, that, you know, white Americans invented slavery. You know, that, you know, natives lived in peace and harmony before the Europeans arrived. These kinds of folk beliefs, which are very powerful, especially among young people, those need to be disabused. So I would say, actually, school is more important than university.
All right, Calvin, thank you very much.
Thanks, Fraser.